All right, welcome everyone to, I believe this is monthly customer secret webinar number 4. I'm liking them. I think we should keep doing them. Those are my thoughts anyway. If you keep showing up, I'll keep doing them. But we've got a big, big group tonight. I'm excited to see a lot of familiar faces here. I saw Pauline Blackwood on there. Girl, I haven't talked to you in forever. So many fun faces. It's Clinton. I already named off a bunch of you. So anyway, why don't we, somebody kick it off with a question, and we'll jump on here and talk about whatever you want. Sky's the limit. I will say, if you guys have been paying attention to the newsletter recently, if you're still signed up for that, I wrote, let me look at my to-do list here. I've been on a bit of a songwriting kick, as you know, with my goal to write 50 songs in 12 weeks. Well, I slacked on it for the middle portion of those 12 weeks and realized I wasn't even close. So as of today, I wrote songs number 38 through 41. So I wrote 4 songs this morning. So the deadline is this Saturday. So we're coming in to the wire. And of the ones I wrote today, I only like 1 or 2 really like them. But, you know, it's funny to me of these, I've written 40 and it'll be 50 when I'm done. It's interesting to how many of them I do like, and also how kind of how easy it's become to write songs when I've written this many. If you're not a songwriter, it applies to recording, mixing, really anything that we talk about. I just happen to be doing it for songwriting because I want to release an album this year and I wanted a bunch of good songs to choose from. But the idea of just doing something over and over and over and getting a lot of reps in, man, it really does. Like, I pumped out a song today, and the first one took me a little over an hour because it wasn't coming together. And then the second one took me about 30 minutes. And it just, that's not saying anything about me. It's just if I do things over and over enough, it starts to kind of flow. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. I see a few people with hands raised, so we'll come to you in a second. Let's see, got a question from Clinton out in Australia. I think he's tuning in from the future because I do believe it's Tuesday there. He says, I finally sorted out compressors. I didn't understand attack time properly. I now know it refers to the amount of time the compressor takes to enable. So it is a gradual turning on after the threshold is reached. So the question is it always linear, or can you get compressors that turn on at different rates? Just curious. That's a good question. So your definition is, I think, almost right. It's not a gradual turning on. That actually is a better definition of the knee feature. If you've ever seen a compressor that has the knee setting, it's essentially a way to gradually turn on compression. So below the threshold, as the signal approaches the threshold, it'll actually start compressing before it crosses the threshold. So a few dB below the threshold, depending on how the knee is set, you might have a 1.5:1 ratio. And then it slowly works its way up to the full whatever ratio you have set for the compressor once it gets to the threshold, which is kind of nice to kind of get gradually into compression. Again, these are things that I don't adjust all that much because it's not like you hear a huge difference when you do it. But as far as attack time, that has to do with, you know, if I hit the snare drum, how much of that snare drum is allowed through before the compressor kicks in. So it is like you said, it depending on how you look at it, I guess it is kind of a gradual compressing. But if you set the compressor to 5 milliseconds, then it's only going to let the first 5 milliseconds of that sound through before it starts to compress. And if you say 50 milliseconds, that's a huge difference. So on something like a snare drum, you can go from a really punchy snare at maybe 30, 40 milliseconds down to a really snappy snare that doesn't have much punch by just shortening the attack time. So your question about is it always linear? Yeah, it's literally just it's almost like you're just saying, compressor, when this crosses the threshold, you wait for this exact amount of time before you compress. So it's literally just a delay almost. It's kind of like if you've seen those plugins that have a look ahead feature where they can look, they'll see something's coming and prepare for it in a sense. It's kind of like that, except it's just, it's almost like you're telling the compressor to be lazy. Longer the attack time, you're saying, hey, why don't you just sit this one out for 50 milliseconds and then you can start working. And generally speaking, if you guys aren't terribly familiar with compression, most things I compress are somewhere between, you know, low numbers of 1 to 5 milliseconds and 50 to 75, sometimes 100, but never really more than that for most things. So we're all talking a tenth of a second or less. And it just comes across, it's more of a tonal thing, and it has to do with how much kind of punch you get out of it. Eric Peterson asks if there are any other instructional videos in the pipe. That's a good question. I've got a lot of things bouncing around in my head. A lot of it actually revolving around maybe re-releasing a lot of the stuff I've done already. So like understanding EQ, and that's 3 years old in the fall. So it might be good to kind of update those and kind of reshoot those with some, because I've learned a lot in the last 3 years, and be good to kind of include all that into a new. So I'm probably going to do that with some of the more popular stuff like EQ and compression. And if you guys own it, or if you buy those between now and then, you get all that new stuff for free. So if I, you know, if the price is $1 million and, you know, includes 18 years worth of content, you'll still get that for free. So whatever you paid is all you ever have to pay. But as far as new stuff, I did think it would be fun to do a spinoff from Dueling Mixes. That would be just a one-time thing called Dueling Productions, where Graham and I compete on producing an entire song instead of just mixing it. So we take the same rough demo of a song and we each produce a full band arrangement of it. I thought that'd be interesting just to see how differently it goes, and to kind of have people see the decision-making process behind all that. And I have, some of you have seen, those of you who are VIP members have seen, I'm probably going to release some sort of an actual print newsletter thing to talk about specifically getting it right at the source and more along the lines of recording, because I don't have a lot of stuff about that, which is not a video at all. It's kind of going the opposite direction. But I am working on a long series of videos for Studio One that will be released for free on my YouTube channel. So those are coming in batches. That's all I can say for now. All right, let's pick the first brave soul and see if we can get an actual on-the-air call here. Chris, are you there, sir? Chris?
This Chris?
That Chris.
Yeah, I'm here.
How are you, sir?
I am good.
Good, good. What's going on? What can I help you with?
My question is about mastering board tapes.
Okay.
I have live concerts of Celtic Harp and Crystal Bowls.
Perfect.
And I need to master them. And I think the right thing to do is recreate some room and then fix a little EQ to make it happy to my ears, and nothing more is required. But yeah. I've never done that before.
So you're talking board, like just straight off the stereo mix from the board of a live performance?
Right off the mix,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah, those are fun and challenging because you can't, you know, you're at the mercy of how it was mixed and balances and stuff like that, but there's a lot you can do. I think, yeah, the first thing I would do is try to recreate the room, which is a lot of fun to do if you guys have never done that, where you maybe take a live recording and at the venue it had this big roomy feel, but the recording doesn't really capture that. So finding a reverb and blending that in so that it generates that is actually, I've done it on a couple different projects, and it's really a fun challenge to try to do and make it, pull it off as sounding realistic and not manufactured after the fact. And that'd be the first thing I would do. And sure, some simple EQ. Just when mastering in general, subtle EQ changes can actually do a lot. You know, a little boost down at 50 to 100 if it needs it, and cutting out some mid-range if it needs it, stuff like that. For that style of music, I wouldn't think you'd have to do a ton more than that. Compression can always help just to get the overall volume up. And even multi-band compression, if you need to fix stuff, you know, I found if stuff is lacking in low end and boosting the lows doesn't help as much, sometimes multi-band compression with like three bands can kind of squash the mids and the upper bands a little bit and lets those lows come through without squashing everything else. But again, for that style of music, I can't imagine you needing to resort to those measures. But a big, huge rock mix that just lacks any low end and punch, you know, because they had subwoofers live and they didn't need that in the mix or whatever, that might be something where that would come in handy. But does that get you
that's
moving in the right direction?
That's perfect. Excellent.
Wonderful. Well, enjoy the hot weather out there. And you're in Arizona, right?
Yes, and it's almost 100.
That is ridiculous. Wow. Well, maybe I'll make my way out there one day.
Come visit.
I will. Thanks, Chris.
Go see Bjorn.
Yeah, I do need to go see him. There are so many people that I've met online, like Bjorgvin, who I've yet to meet in person, but one of these days we'll make it happen. All right, I see a few more people with hands raised. We'll get to you. We'll strew you throughout this call. Johnny Fuller, best last name ever, is asking about expanders. Can you explain what an expander is, how it compares to compression, and what the heck one would use it for? That's a good question. There's a video, if any of you own Understanding Compression, I did, since releasing it, I did add a bonus video that kind of goes through gates and expanders. So if you happen to own that, go back in the download area, you'll see there's an extra video there. But in general, an expander is kind of the opposite of a compressor, but it's hard to know. It's not really the opposite. Like, I don't use it. If compression doesn't work, I don't use an expander. Expander for me is just to turn down noise. So the two uses where I would use it the most, and I don't use them all that much. But one would be if I've got just a voiceover. So for my podcast, and even for my tutorial videos lately, you'll hear it too. But specifically for the podcast, you'll hear, and I talked about this a couple episodes ago, just the general of getting a voice up loud enough between the preamp, and just the amount of compression and limiting to get it to a nice mastered level. There tends to be, in a home studio, it tends to bring up the overall noise level too. And so one of the ways to deal with that, obviously, is to try to get your room as quiet as possible, but we're all in home studios and that's just, you can only do so much. So the real way to deal with that is to use some sort of an expander. And what the expander does is when I stop talking, it turns the signal down. A gate is the same thing as an expander, except it turns the sound all the way down, or down like 60 dB or so. And that can sound unnatural. It sounds like my voice is being muted every time I take a breath. That can be unnatural. But if you have it just turn it down 10 to 14 dB, then you still hear some of the room noise, but it's turned down a lot. And it has the effect of making the room sound much quieter, making the recording sound much cleaner. So that's one example. And that again, doesn't apply to music as much. But the other big example for that is drums. Specifically, if you've got toms where they're picking up too much of the snare and the kick drum and they're ringing too much, I usually do two things. I either just edit the toms out to where I'm only seeing just they're only playing when there's a tom hit, but that takes more time. If I can make an expander work, then I'll throw one on there. And you'll hear people talk about gating the toms. That's what they're talking about. It's just having, unless the toms are being hit, have them turned down quite a bit. And Lewis is asking, would you recommend a gate or an expander on drums? And you know, I would have said expander because I almost always use expanders. But just now as I'm thinking about it, a gate makes more sense because it essentially will do the same thing as editing the audio out between sections. So I think next time I need to use it, I'm going to throw a gate on there. Because whenever I edit the toms, it sounds totally unnatural by themselves. But in the mix, you don't hear, you just hear the big tom hit and it goes away and you don't even notice that it's not there anymore. Interesting. Good question there, Johnny. Eric is asking something about, back to talking about a new video. Something about effects plugins would be nice, delay, reverb, etc. Yeah, I did do a video, or there's a couple, I think, on reverb and delay that I've done in the VIP members area. Eric, I can't remember if you're a VIP member, but might be worth checking out for just 10 bucks for a month, just to go see those. There's one on four steps to setting up a delay and or setting up a reverb. It just really kind of cuts through all the crap and lets you just get to setting it up. And then there was a longer video that I did a while back on reverbs and delays. That might be helpful for you. Dan says, besides getting it right at the source, what is your number one most important recording advice? Ooh. I can't. when you put besides getting it right at the source, I have a hard time. I don't know if there is anything else I would say. Most number one, most important recording advice, aside from getting it right at the source. Because it all kind of, I could actually categorize almost anything under getting it right at the source. But I would say I would say one big thing is having fun. If you are miserable, then you're missing the entire point. And that could mean if you're miserable because you always do 15 takes of vocals and it takes you 3 months to work through them and get to the best take, then maybe go practice singing for a while and then come back and record. Or, I don't know. I think that's a big one. I think also, don't work on a song unless it's a song worth working on. I think a lot of people might just slap a song together or record a really bad song in hopes that they can rescue it with fun, fancy recording techniques. But if you don't like the song, it's going to be hard to want to do anything right or well as you work through it. All right, Pauline, I'm coming after you. Let's see if we can do this. Pauline, are you there?
What are you going for?
Hello.
Hello. I can hear you.
Oh, you can hear me?
Uh-huh. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thanks.
That's awesome. You're up in Canada, right?
I am, up in Toronto.
Wonderful. Well, what can I help you with?
I don't have a question. I must have had my hand up.
Well, that's awesome. Well, good. Well, I'm glad you're here. I haven't heard from you in a while. It's good to hear you.
Yeah.
All right. I will mute you back.
Okay, then.
That's awesome. See, the whole hand raising thing is kind of working, but it also, you may not be able to put your hand back down. So that's great. If anyone has their hand raised, put it back down and put it back up so I know who to get to. Okay. Don is asking about, let's see, parallel compression. Is it possible to get it with the wet dry setting, or should you compress hard on another channel and mix it in with the original track? That's a great question. A few years ago, I didn't have a compressor with a wet dry setting. So, you know, reverbs and delays all have it, but compressors didn't. And it's a brilliant thing because Studio One includes that with their compressor, which is cool. So I say if I'm doing parallel compression, honestly, it's the same either way. I personally like to have the compressed signal on its own fader so I can blend it in without having to open a plugin. So that's more just a workflow thing, but technically the same thing's going on. The thing I use parallel compression the most on would be drums. And so I like to have the overall drum mix compressed some, and then I like to also parallel compress that with some heavier compression to just kind of bring out the kind of the ring of the drums and stuff like that. So for me, it would involve two compressors if I did it with the mix knob. But the mix knob gets a little funny because you'll have the drum level set, everything sounds good, and as you adjust the mix knob, you're going to kind of adjust the overall volume of the kit. So then you're having to do that dance between adjusting the mix knob and then adjusting the fader and going back and forth. So in my mixes, I'm thinking about the last 10 mixes I've done. If I've done parallel compression, it's almost all of them have been on their own track, so their own auxiliary track where I can just listen to it. I can quickly solo it and just hear the parallel compression part, and then I can just move the fader up and down to blend it in. So that's how I like to do it. Steve says he has two burning questions. Let's see. The first is LCR guitar versus left right using the same / unaltered WAV file. So I'm not quite understanding you. You're saying using the exact same guitar part and figuring out a way to make it sound left and right? Oh, it's, your hand's raised. Never mind. Let's unmute you. Okay, go.
Hey, Joe.
Hey, Steve.
I let Mark Maxwell know you said hi.
Okay, awesome.
From Moms. So here's the situation on the first question I was trying to get. This is basically a dispute that my guitar player and I are debating about, so to speak. And I know part of the answer here is get it right at the source, and ideally you want to go in there and record double tracking the guitar and get the different sounds and do all those types of things. And what we're stuck with is we've got basically one decent guitar track that we're trying to get a full sound for the guitar. And I believe putting just kind of a left and a right of that same wave file is the equivalent of doing a left CR mix of that wave. And I'm just kind of curious to get your opinion on that.
When you say LCR, what do you mean when you say that?
Left, center, right.
So, okay, so yeah.
Put one track, full pan left, full pan right, and then one dead in the center.
Yeah, if you take, so we're talking the exact same part, just duplicating it.
Yeah, and I think there's probably no difference in doing that.
Yeah, if you duplicate it and do one hard left and one hard right, it's the exact same thing as having just one pan to the middle. It might be a little louder,
yeah,
but it's not going to give you any width. And you'll notice that as soon as you do it, you'll say, hey, that didn't change anything.
Well, and I think that's what he's reacting to is basically the volume, but he is, I cannot convince him differently.
It'll
that,
be
the wall of sound that he's hearing is not really a wall of sound.
It'll be like a 3 dB difference. So probably the best way to test him is to maybe have three tracks, one pan to the middle turned up 3 dB, and then the other two together 3 dB lower, because when they combine, it's going to add about 3 dB of volume. And then he may be able to hear, okay, that is no different. But it's the kind of thing I get, like sometimes doubling just comes easily, and then sometimes the part just doesn't lend itself to being doubled. And I mastered an album last month, and they took a single guitar part and tried to make it sound wide by using doubling the part and then delaying it a few milliseconds, 10-15 milliseconds, and it gave this really wide sound, but it was completely out of phase, so the whole mix was kind of thrown off because of these trying to take one part and make it wide. So
part of the challenge we have with those too.
Yeah So I mean, you could maybe try feeding it into some sort of cool stereo delay that will be, it'll still be in the middle, but you'll have some delay behind it, or maybe some reverb that can widen things out and give it some fullness, but it may not fit the part. Another thing would just be to record a few more and see if you can get two that work well together, pan left and right.
Part of the challenge that we have on his too, he's got the heavy flange or heavy effect on there. So as soon as you try to do a slip on it, you're going to get that phase just with the flange.
Yeah.
One of the things that we have tried that I'd be curious to get your thoughts on this as well, is we tried to put different plugins on the different tracks to give it that stereo width. But occasionally the plugins sound like they're fighting with one another, even though everything's in phase. And so there's something going on with just the way that the two plugins are EQing that track, and I'm curious to know why that's happening when it really shouldn't be a phase issue.
Well, I guess you're still working with the same piece of audio two different ways, so it's not going to be different enough. You could have all lows on one side and all highs on the other, and it's still going to not really sound that wide because it is still the exact same piece of audio. It wants to be mono because that's what it is. You could, if you're having issues, one thing is if you double something that doesn't sound good doubled, then maybe have him dial back the amount of overdrive or the amount of effects that he has on the single track, and he won't like that as well. But then when you blend the two together, it might work really well. Anytime I'm doubling guitars, if I really like the tone I've got, I'll dial it back just a little, so that it's a little cleaner. So when I have two together, there's not that buildup of kind of upper mid range that can kind of kill it.
Got it.
Cool.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks for hopping on, Steve. Fun. All right. Let me see what else we got here in the question box. Jason, my Baton Rouge buddy, says this is about mastering. We got a couple questions about mastering, so let's see if we can knock those out. Says, I feel like I'm getting a good overall balance, but there's something that seems too harsh. Maybe around 1 to 3K compared to commercial recordings. Is this normal? Do you consciously try to cut out some here or here? I'm sorry, I can't read. Do you consciously try to cut some around there to avoid buildup when mixing? In other words, the mix played at lower volume sounds good, but turning it up will hurt my ears before the commercial tracks will. And he's eating jambalaya right now. Man, I'm jealous. Jason, I go through seasons. So for a while, it'll be the upper mids that'll be standing out compared to commercial mixes. And then I'll be more conscious of that when I'm mixing or maybe mastering, and then it'll be the low mids. And then the next, it'll be the super low end. And then just the dead right in the mid range. So it changes for me. I don't try. You're asking if I consciously try to think about it. I do, but I also just it comes for me. It's more in the mixing phase of just being familiar with what a commercial track sounds like in my studio, and then getting my ears familiar enough to where if mine is way off, I can kind of start to notice, hey, that's feeling a little harsh. Let me go find those three tracks that are kind of sitting in that 1 to 3K range. And let me do either turn them down or do a cut on the EQ there. Stuff like that will always be better than having to do a cut at 3K in mastering, because you end up cutting everything at 3K and it might end up dulling the mix and being hard to really get what you want. But at the same time, a couple dB might be all it takes. I will say I definitely experienced that. The mix sounds great mixed, and then when you go to mastering and you start hitting it up to those higher levels and just hitting the limiter, even just a little bit to get it up within kind of commercial range of volume, not killing it, just decent volume, I do notice that things stand out more when it's hitting that limiter a little bit. But at that point, a little bit of EQ and compression can usually fix it. I will say if perhaps maybe you should just work in mixing at louder volumes as kind of a part of your normal workflow. Because you said when you turn up the professional mixes, you can keep turning them up and it doesn't hurt your ears. But with yours, it's you can't get them as loud without it starting to hurt. And maybe just, I'm not saying mix at 85 dB for 4 hours at a time, but just occasionally pop it up there and take note of what stands out and then turn it back down and address those spots and those issues. That might help a lot. Okay, there's another question from Jerry. Says, just recently completed the Home Mastering Masterclass, the Ian Shepherd course that I've promoted before. Ian's great. He mastered my last album. Love that guy. He said, I'm using the Presonus 1642 with Studio One Pro software. I was wondering about the Fab Filter plugins. They're on sale for their 10-year anniversary, 40% off, and Ian's Perception plugin. Budget is around $600. Appreciate your input. You know, Jerry, the last time I bought plugins was when I worked at Sweetwater, which was over 5 years ago. I still own the Waves bundle that I bought back then, the SSL and the Gold bundle. And I really just use that bus compressor for SSL. That's the main thing I use. So I don't know anything about the Fab Filter plugins. Okay, that's not true. I did buy a VU meter plugin once about a year or two ago for mastering. And I bought the TT Dynamic Range meter for mastering. Okay, so those are the two plugins I've bought. But, you know, I've heard good things about Fab Filter. And again, it sounds more like more of a creative plugin than just a standard EQ compressor kind of thing. So that'd be more into that sort of thing. But honestly, I am constantly finding things I can do with the same old plugins I've had for years. So I may not be the right person to ask. As far as Ian's Perception plugin, he did give me a copy to try out and to review. I just got the email about it last week, so I haven't installed it yet. But from what I've seen from his demos of it, it seems great. If you're doing any amount of mastering, it seems like a great plugin to help decide if you're actually doing anything except making it louder and if you're making the song sound better. And I think it's a great, I'm surprised there's not anything out there that does that. And you said, okay, the follow-up question says he's just starting out. I would say if you're just starting out, I wouldn't get too caught up in buying more stuff. If anything, it gives you more stuff to learn and have to work through, and when really the basics are where you want to hang out for a long, long time. It's just like with any other profession. You know, the first day of shop class, you know, you're not building a car, you know, you're nailing two pieces of wood together or something ridiculous, but you got to get those basics down. So I'd say as cool as those things are and as great a deal as they might be, if you're just starting out, I don't think they're going to benefit you all that much. Clinton, he was wanting to suggest a how do you fix it section on Home Studio Corner. people send in a problem in their mix and members can download it and try to fix it, like a thin vocal. And in the forum, they can chat on how they solve the problems. We love to have little challenges like that. You know, I like the idea, but at the same time, it seems like it's promoting fixing stuff instead of getting it right at the source. Now, I know there's some things you can only get it as good as you can get it, and then you work from there. And so I think there might be some benefit to fixing some stuff, but I don't want to put out there that, because I've done albums that I've had to mix where I've had to fix so much. And if I go back and the next time I'm recording those acoustic guitars, I really focus on getting them to sound right, then I'm not having to do any of those fixing tricks that don't really work anyway. Eric says, if you had an unknown singer in your studio, would you use a limiter to prevent digital overs with their voice? Or would you just record at a very low level? I would just record at a normal level, maybe halfway up the meter. And it depends on the song. If it's one they're not belting on, then I don't have to worry about it even more. But I may use a little compression on the channel strip. But if you don't have a compressor, again, the vocal will sound just as good if it's hitting halfway up the meter than if it's hitting just shy of clipping. It's the exact same sound. You don't get any added benefit by having it louder. And if it's way too loud, too quiet in the mix later, you can always turn it up and it's not going to change the tone at all, which is great because then you can just leave it at a conservative level and you don't have to worry about clipping. You can worry about all the other stuff you have to worry about, like making them sing well. Nadim says, I'm trying to write new songs. I have 10 songs worth of music and some chorus lyrics that don't mean anything to me other than melodically sounding good and catchy. But I'm having trouble with lyrics. Can you share any secrets to writing lyrics? Do you use a thesaurus or a generator? I don't use a thesaurus. So for me, I've always loved to write. And so, you know, that comes across in doing like the daily newsletter that I do. And I write in a journal most days, and I'm used to using words. So for me, writing a song is just kind of taking those words and narrowing them down to get a thought across in a few words per line, and then hopefully having some things rhyme too. So for me, I wish I had more advice. I think if you don't already write regularly, whether it's an article or just something in a journal or just some way to put thoughts on paper, I feel like exercising that muscle will help you just be good at thinking of words for things that you're feeling or thinking. And when you get to the point in the song where this song is going in this general direction, it's funny. Sometimes I'll have an idea for a song and then the words just kind of come out, and then, you know, I'll be stuck with a rhyme that I need to happen. And I guess because I use words so much, the rhymes just kind of come and they start to make sense and kind of just able to kind of let the song come to life. So that is a horrible answer to your question. I wish I had a better answer for you, but I don't. Freddie says, I know that mid-side processing can be a very deep, dark jungle. I don't currently have any dedicated mid-side plugins. Is it worth taking a mix and using a simple mid-side plugin to split the stereo mix to independent mid and side group tracks for separate processing and then combine them back to a single stereo track? Freddie, the only things I've done with mid-side have to do with recording, so actually mid-side recording. I've never done any mid-side processing on mixing or mastering. Now, I know Ian Shepherd does and teaches that in his course, and I'm sure there are places to use it, and I'm sure it's incredible, but I've never gotten into it. And I don't feel like I'm missing a whole lot because of it. So I don't know if it'd be worth it. For me, I'm still working on getting better mixes using the basic tools, and I'm still getting better. So I guess once I stop getting better, I'll look to more fancy things to try. But for now, I've got so much improving to go and so much work to do. I'll keep myself busy for a long time. Another question from Steve. How to reduce a hot hi-hat in the overhead drum mics without losing cymbals? I've tried EQ, but can't seem to find a way to have my cake and eat it too. Cake being the less hi-hat and the eat it too being the cymbals or the crashes. Any suggestions? Well, that's a tough one. a big part of that is being able to catch that during recording and just say, hey, drummer, lay off the hi-hat, or try placing the overheads in a different place where they're not picking up as much hi-hat. But sometimes if I'm in that situation, I'm mixing an album right now that doesn't have a hi-hat mic. And the drummer just doesn't play the hi-hat all that much, but it picks up a lot of snare and toms with the overheads. They must have been very close to the kit, because the toms almost sound big and full without the tom mics at all, which is kind of interesting. But in some of the songs, the toms are too loud in the overheads. And I turn the tom mics all the way down, and they're still too loud in the overheads. So really the only solution is to EQ out a lot of the lows and the mids to hopefully get those toms down in the overheads, and the overheads essentially just turn into cymbal mics. So a lot of times I approach overheads as, let me pull them up and get the overall sound of the kit, and then as they, you know, and build the mix around that. However, if there's a problem in the overheads, like one thing is too loud, then I can't do that. And at that point, I have to use the overheads more like just cymbal mics than more of a feel for the whole kit. And when that happens, I generally roll off a lot of the low end and sometimes a lot of the mids and just have the upper mids and highs coming through. So maybe do the roll off and then also boost up around 12 to 15K to just get that shimmer from the cymbals, and then bring the fader down quite a bit. And that may be enough to get you the shimmer from the cymbals, and then have that kind of upper mid-range of the hi-hat not cut through as much. And sometimes if the hi-hat is a problem, you can do a pretty significant cut at like that 3 to 5K range, and then that can cut it enough to where when you boost the upper highs, you kind of get that nice shimmery cymbal without as much of the hi-hat. But I don't know. Danny boy, Daniel Lyle says he thinks he has his hand up. I don't think you do. Click it again. I can't find you in the list of names. Hang on. There you are. Let's bring Danny boy on for a question. Are you there, sir?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Boom. I can hear you. What's going on?
Sweet. Not much. Okay, so I have a question about multi-band compression.
Okay.
I just recently upgraded to the full version of Studio One.
Cool.
And so I never had multi-band before. And so I've been getting mixes where, like, I got them, like, where I feel like they're towards 100%, they're almost done.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've been throwing, just out of curiosity, throwing the multi-band onto the master bus at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of scares me a little bit, because if something happens, and typically it's like, oh, wow, that sounds really good. But it's almost unnerving, because I don't understand why it sounds good. Like, I don't understand what's happening or what I'm doing or anything.
Yeah.
And I'd almost rather not use it, because I don't understand. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I've kind of been there, too. I've only been using multiband for a couple years, and even then I don't use it all that much. And when I first started using it, I was the same way. I thought, oh man, it just, my low end just kind of came to life, and it's got a little more snap in the top end, and everything just kind of, you know, kind of like that Bose smiley face curve thing where the lows and highs are boosted, and it just,
exactly, sounds, I feel,
quote,
like,
quote,
it
better. Yeah. So
yeah, I feel like it kind of glues the whole thing together.
It can. And when I
turn it off, I'm like, oh, well, that sounds boring.
What I found is it tends to hype things, because the way I use it is that the way Ian Shepherd teaches in he's got that multi-band compression ebook. He teaches just to use three bands instead of five. So from 0 to 160, 160 to about 2.5K, and then 2.5K up. And to treat them all with the same settings on everything. So it's kind of like a single compressor that just compresses the different sections depending on how loud they are. And when you do it that way, the mid-range is going to generally be the loudest one, just because that's where everything is, the vocals and most of the guitars and everything else. So that's going to obviously get compressed more. And a lot of times that's a good thing, because you end up getting a tighter vocal sound, and all the guitars and drums or the snare and things like that tend to kind of tighten up a little bit without killing the high end and without, you know, completely obliterating the low end. And it ends up sounding sometimes like the highs are getting boosted and the lows are getting boosted. And I think for me, I went through that kind of honeymoon phase of it makes everything better to either my mixes got better and didn't need as much improving, or I just got used to it and realized that it was hyping things a little bit. But I started to realize that, I guess I started to get to a point where I recognized what, when I was listening to a mix that could be helped by multiband and when I was listening to one that couldn't. And so I, now when I'm like doing mixing and mastering on the same, on a, like a, I'm doing both the mixing and the mastering, there'll be, if it's a 6-song EP, I might use multiband on maybe half of them. Which sounds crazy, but it just, if it's almost more like a corrective tool for me than it is a tonal thing. If I feel like the low end just isn't punchy enough, then I'll put the multiband on there, and then it'll usually make the highs too harsh. So I have to use, maybe go in an EQ before the multiband to kind of bring the highs down a little bit to kind of compensate for that. But yeah, it does hype things, and that can be a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it can also go too far, and it's hard to kind of come back from there when you're all excited about how much quote unquote better it sounded.
Okay, well then two follow-up questions. Mm-hmm. One would be, you know, how should I approach it at this point, given the fact that I know nothing about it? And two, what would be some good further sources for study?
I would say to approach it, I would not get into, I've gone down the rabbit trail of kind of tweaking each band individually, and it tends to just fall apart because you start, it just, things start to sound thin and weird because you start adjusting each band individually. So I would say treat it more like a regular compressor where you're linking all the thresholds and the ratios to be the same. Mm-hmm. And Ian recommends doing like 100 millisecond attack and release. So it's not super aggressive, but it can get the job done pretty well. And then I would just say, you know, get a little bit of gain reduction happening and kind of see, just kind of see what happens from there. You know, do a lot of A-B-ing and listening, and just if it does help, great. What you might find is you try it and you kind of think that's interesting, but I don't quite trust it yet. I'm going to take it off. And then on the next project, maybe you add it back and take a few chances with it and see what you can do. That's how I did it. I put it on there and kind of ruined a few masters with it and learned from it, and then, you know, moved a little further down and got a little braver and just kind of kept playing around with it.
Okay.
There's actually, I'll put a link here in the chat thing as far as you asked about resources. I did a webinar with Ian when he was releasing his ebook on multiband compression.
Okay.
And it's about an hour long where he talks about a lot of this stuff. So it's at multibandcompression.com. There's a little form there and it'll send you the video. And then he's got an ebook for sale too that you can buy. But the webinar is actually really fun. And he's British, so I mean, kind of a win-win there. Get to listen to his asset. I think
you have an interview with him too in the VIP section, right?
Yep, we did. We did an interview on just mastering in general, I think.
Okay.
Which is also great. He's just He's a cool dude. Definitely, I kind of just bounce all mastering questions over to him because he's the guy I'm learning from. I still don't feel like I could do it justice. So definitely worth, I mean, he's got a lot of good stuff on his website too. Worth checking out.
Yeah, I haven't checked him out too much. I'm too busy looking at all your stuff.
Tear yourself away.
Yes.
Like I said, the British accent, man, he's got me beat.
Yeah. Cool. It's all right. You got that. You kind of seem to have somewhat of a southern draw going on.
I've got the drawl. I can whip out the drawl when I need to.
Yeah.
Cool deal. Well, cool, man. Thanks for hopping on.
All right.
Yep.
Bye.
All right, folks. We got about, I'm showing 13 minutes, and I still got a few questions in here. So let's jump on a few more. Speaking of multiband, Tom was asking, have you tried the Tri-Comp compressor in Studio One? Tom, I saw, when I was at PreSonosphere, I saw a few people using it, and I still don't understand what it does. It either makes things sound louder or weird, or I don't know. I think it's some sort of simple version of multiband compression, but I haven't played around with it, and I haven't looked it up in the manual to see what it does. But I do know I've listened to some mixes that people have thrown that on the master, and it's made it sound kind of bad. So I'm not blaming the tool as much as the tool that's using it. Chris was saying in the old days, they mixed on Auratone 5C speakers in mono. So those little block-shaped speakers. Oh. Now, in the new days, we mix to a 32K AAC Plus over a cellular network. How do I begin to think about this delivery mechanism? Well, I don't care about what my song sounds like over a cellular network. And, you know, these lesser forms. Ian Shepherd, and we keep coming back to Ian. I don't know where it was. It was on his blog over at productionadvice.co.uk. He did a post about why you shouldn't master for MP3 and should master for the best quality. So people were saying if everyone listens on MP3, then you should really only be concerned with what it sounds like as an MP3. And he used an example of a video, a high definition video shown on like a small window on the computer screen next to a lower resolution video. And when you look at the smaller versions, you actually think the lower resolution one looks better. But when you click on them and make them go full screen, you can see the better resolution video is far superior than the lower resolution one. And kind of that idea of get it as good as you can get it on the best system as you can, and it'll generally translate better as you go down in quality. And that, you know, it's all kind of theory, but I mean, I'm mixing and making it sound good. And then if I make it sound good in my studio, and then it's working in the car and other speakers and stuff, I'm kind of happy. And I go from there. Clinton is asking, when trying to cut down on sibilance, I tend to find that there are two bands of sibilance occurring in tandem and not one. I think this is maybe harmonic sibilance. I fix it by using multiband de-essing. Any comments? Well, yeah, de-essing is essentially multiband compression that just listens to, just listens to the upper frequency range. So that's fine. I would say, yeah, generally there's kind of the, somewhere in like the 1 to 3K, there's some part of the sibilance there. And then up at like 5 to 7 or 8K is where kind of the bulk of that sibilance happens. And I tend to just kind of move that, whatever the frequency band is on the de-esser around, to cut off whatever's cutting my head off. So there's usually, it's the upper frequencies that are really bothering me. If I cut those and it still sounds weird, then I'll just bring that frequency down more and more until it's kind of cutting everything uniformly. Sometimes a de-esser combined with like a notch EQ can help, but that's generally what I do. Or sometimes I need to just back off compression in general so that it's not causing so much sibilance. Sometimes compression makes the sibilance worse, so you can kind of compromise there. Sebastian has a question about noise. I have a Rode NT1A and a big window in my recording room, so even I close the window, it always records the outside noise. Is there any trick to avoid this other than trying to escape from that noise? Well, I would say my question to you is, does the noise show up in the actual recording in the mix, or is the noise just there when you listen in solo? Because I've had plenty of songs where I've forgotten to go in and edit out sections on a voice, for example, like my vocal where I cough or I'm drinking a sip of water or I knock something over and I forget to actually go. And that's obviously very loud in the vocal and it gets picked up by the microphone. But then I'll go back and listen to the mix and I don't hear those things. So a lot of times what we think is an issue with noise is really just something we're making up, because in the final context of the mix, it doesn't matter. Now, if you're doing a very simple, intimate guitar vocal song where there aren't a lot of instruments to hide behind, then at that point it can be an issue. But even then, I would venture to say it's not as big of an issue as we like to make it. I've talked about this before. One of my favorite albums was one produced by a friend of mine, Brent Milligan. It's the Stephen Curtis Chapman album called Beauty Will Rise. And they recorded a lot of the guitars and things on that album while they were on tour. So Brent had an Inbox 2 with a kind of a high-end converter and preamp and microphones running into the SPDIF input of that. And so they weren't in great places to record. And there's a few songs where the intro of the song, you could hear a good bit of noise. Not like people walking around, just kind of hiss from the equipment and the room and stuff like that. And it doesn't bother me at all. If anything, I actually like it. And it kind of makes me like it a little bit more because it has some of these imperfections in it. What I would say is it's probably not as big of a deal. And if it is, one thing that I've done is I had a guy in Nashville build the two gobos for me. So they're these big freestanding frames on casters or wheels, and they're 6 feet tall by 3 feet wide, and they're about, I think, 4 inches thick. And so they, I can set those up between me and the window, and they block out a lot of that sound. And so that's something that if you just want to go get some 2x4s, some insulation and some cloth and build something like that for yourself, that can help just literally block a lot of that noise from getting into the microphone. But again, that would only be helpful if it really was a noise issue, like we said before. What do you think about ear training software? Do we need that to get better? I like the guys that make Quiztones. Dan's a buddy of mine, and it's cool. I don't use it a lot, and I know it's helpful, but I find it easier to do ear training while mixing. If you've seen my Understanding EQ videos, I teach you how to do basically take two copies of a mix, flip the phase so there's silence, and then use an EQ, and anything you boost or cut, you'll hear just that range that's being boosted or cut. It's a great way to learn what 200 hertz sounds like, what 50 hertz sounds like, what 500 hertz sounds like in an actual mix. I think that's more helpful because you may think you know what 200 hertz sounds like, but in reality, it might be a lot higher than what you were thinking. You might think 200 hertz is a low frequency, but it's not really. It's a low mid, but it's actually got a lot more, like a lot of vocal sits in 200. Not as much bass and kick drum that you might think. That's the kind of thing I thought for a long time until I realized, oh, goodness gracious, there's a lot, it's a lot higher than I thought at 200 hertz. Higher pitch, I guess. Another question. You always talk about listening to good mixes on our speakers. So since you have a much more trained ears, which songs would you recommend for us to listen? You know, it's a good question. I'll throw out a couple that I listen to a lot. The Wallflowers, Bringing Down the Horse. I just think it's a great sounding album. I'll use U2 Joshua Tree. Although every time I listen, I think, why isn't the bass louder? I don't know. I think honestly, it's whatever music you love the most. Chris said Lyle Lovett's stuff with his big band. Yeah, his stuff sounds fantastic. Anything I think that you think sounds good, because it's all subjective. What I think is amazing and full and clear, you might think is harsh and ugly. That's my take on it. If it's you listen to something and you think this sounds amazing, don't worry about what anybody else thinks, because somebody thought it sounded awful, somebody else thought it sounded amazing. So I'd say just pick your favorite albums, maybe stuff that sounds a little bit like what you listen to and the kind of music you work on, because that's going to be more helpful. If I said, one of Marilyn Manson's albums is just sounds really great and was mixed really well, not really going to help me because I don't do any music that's anywhere close to what that sounds like. So, stay in the same style of music, that might help. Random question from Dan says, at your church, do you guys have the room/audience mic in your ears? Trying to get used to this whole no amp thing. Yeah, when I first started using in-ears, it was painful. But yes, we do, unless we're out of inputs, we do have a couple of room mics, and I'll crank those up pretty good. Because it does help me feel less crazy, like I'm in a black hole. Steve says, kind of back to the mastering topic, should you stick with presets on things like Isotope, Ozone 5? I don't know, honestly. I tend to think presets might be good starting points, but they might be a little too over the top. I don't know. I think Graham, I don't own Ozone, so I've not used it. I know Graham Cochran raves about it. Might be worth looking at. Their presets might be good. I don't know. Let's see. Lewis says, can you give us a hint of what genre next month's dueling mix is, you know, I wish I could. I haven't started my mix, and we picked it, but then I can't remember. It's some sort of vibey. It's a little different. It has the word Africa in the name. It's been so long since I listened to it. I'll have to mix it in the next 10 days. So I will let you know next month. Sorry. Okay. Workflow. Here's one from Chris. When do you put the recorded track into the vault, never to be altered again? Clearly, copies get altered. When do I put the recorded track into the vault? Are you talking about editing or re-recording or comping and things like that? I get more and more where a lot of stuff, I try to get it where I want it to be when the recording session's over. I haven't comped anything as far as recording 5 takes and comping them together in a long time. For example, with the VIP series I did over the last couple of weeks on doing just a guitar vocal demo, I recorded the vocal one pass and then went through and punched in the sections I didn't like. And then I listened a few days later and realized the whole thing I didn't like very much. So I recorded it all again, deleted what I had, recorded it all again, liked that much better, and then punched in the spots I didn't like until I was happy with them. But I don't think that was your question, Chris. You're talking about saving a track. So from 10 years from now, you still have one. I don't know. I mean, I've got old sessions on old hard drives in my closet that I don't even know if they work anymore that I may like to pull out. I think there tends to be some people who like to go back and remix and re-record stuff. I tend to see it as I'm constantly improving in every area of music. So the songs I wrote 10 years ago and the way I recorded them and the way I performed them and the way I mixed them, all of those things have gotten better. So I would rather not go get what I consider an inferior song and an inferior recording and try to mix it. I'd rather write a new one and all new everything, if that makes sense. But then again, that said, I feel like I've written some really great songs in the last few months. Maybe I want to go back and rework one in a completely different way. So yeah, I'm all for saving that stuff and keeping it on, you know, not ditching it when you're done. But I also haven't gone back and opened up an old session. I can't remember the last time I did that. Okay, final question. We got to get out of here. This is from Steve. Recommendation on same versus different reverb on main and backing volume. I guess you mean vocals. Or is it okay to have different verb on the main or the lead vocal or all over the mix? I tend to, if I can, try to have the same reverb on everything just because I'm lazy. But for me, the vocal is one of the last things that I address in the mix. So by the time I get to the vocal, I've probably put a reverb on in there somewhere on drums probably. And if I can make the vocal work in that drum reverb, so if I slap if I do a send it to the drum reverb and it works, then I'm good to go. If it doesn't, then I'll try another reverb if it needs it. But a lot of times I'll maybe try delay first before trying reverb. But lately I've been mixing more and more where I'll have one reverb that works well for the drums, and then I'll send a little bit of everything to it. And it's not the kind of thing you obviously hear in the mix, but when you turn the reverb off, you notice that the mix kind of gets a little closer to you. And so it gives a little bit of depth to the overall mix, and not in a way of, oh, I hear that reverb. It just more of the, oh, when I mute the reverb, everything sounds a little bit more like it's in a drum, in a vocal booth, as opposed to in an open space. It's actually really interesting and very subtle. I should probably try to capture that in a video at some point. It might be kind of cool. But yeah, I just because I'm lazy and I keep things simple, if I can do it with just one reverb, I'm happy to do it that way. It makes me very happy. All right, folks, our hour is up. You have been great. Fantastic questions. Quick one from Grover says, are the PreSonus videos going to be through your website or under your name on YouTube? And any plans to do Melodyne videos? I don't know Melodyne well enough to teach anything about it. Grover. So, but yes, if you go to homestudiocorner.com/presonus, there's a mailing list you can get on. I should be putting up a new batch of videos, I think this week. It might be next week before they get up. But those will all be free, and you can access them on YouTube too. There's a playlist for just those, and they'll all be free. And real quick from Jason, what method do you use to harness your creativity? I recently dedicated my music to my faith in Christ, and I'm looking for ways to express it without being corny. Jason, that's a good question and something to talk about. As a Christian and a songwriter, you know, you don't want to belittle what you believe in, but you also don't want to ignore it and never talk about it. So I try to kind of incorporate it in more subtle but also kind of obvious ways. And then I also know that, like, I just personally think I don't have to make every song about Jesus to be doing good work, you know what I mean, and making good music. I think that's just one way of doing it. But, you know, I can write a song about, you know, I wrote a song last week about how the weather sometimes makes me sad. Good, pretty weather makes me sad, which is just kind of crazy, and the song's called Psychopath. You know, I've written songs about, you know, hurting my wife's feelings and working through that, and just all kinds of things, but it doesn't, for me, it's all life. I think it all applies. So anyway, and Dan says, preach it. That's awesome. All right, folks, I am done. These allergies are killing me. This is as much as I can talk in one evening. So thank y'all. These were great questions. I'll have the recording posted if you want to check that out, and I'll send an email about it. But thank you all for being a customer, supporting Home Studio Corner. I love you all. See ya.